You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me once again, he's back. It was as promised. He's going to come back for another time. We could keep talking forever. He is Mr. Mark Serby. He is the author of Al Pacino's The Movies Behind the Man, and he's a rabid consumer of all sorts of masculine, macho, machismo movies like this. He's also a film critic and a broadcaster in the UK, so if you're in the UK listener, hello and welcome. I know there are some of you out there. I know it isn't just Mark that's listening to these episodes following along, so you know where to find him. Mark, mate, thank you so much for coming back to One Heat Minute.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me back on, Blake. I mean, you know, you've done, once again, like the last time, you've sort of built me up way bigger. I kind of like it. You know, you're going there. He's a consumer of action movies, machismo. I'm thinking, you must be looking at a different picture to me, mate. I'll be honest. But there we go. I'll take it. I'll happily take that.
Take
any introduction like that.
It's
fine with me.
One little project that Mark's working on at the moment, and I won't spoil anything just in case there's any embargo, but he's told me about, particularly about the special features of a film that he's sort of he's working on an anniversary release of a cult film where he's gotten to chat to a director, and I'm freaking excited is all I'll say. So keep an eye out on Mark's Twitter. He'll let you know when the appropriate time is for that. But mate, thank you for coming back. We're at the 78th minute. You know, and I just said this like just before hitting record to you. It's scary now because we are nearly halfway through this project.
Halfway. It's incredible to think as well, you know, halfway, realistically, most halfway films are around what, the 45, 50 minute mark, you know, something like
could
that.
Could have been a 90 minute, could have been 120 minutes. I could be two thirds of the way through, but not with Heat. I chose.
No. Chose one of the longest films. I mean, that would be like me choosing The Godfather Part 2 and thinking, Jeez. This is a good idea. Rip through this in a year. And now look what's happened. Like, you're now, 7 years into this project?
Not quite seven. It's actually crazy. It was one of those things that, and so for folks who know, you know, the goal of One Heat Minute is 2 episodes a week, and a couple of times we've stalled and we had to go one, and then you guys will do a catch up week where it's 3 episodes the next week, etc. But it was literally 2 episodes a week so that it would be done in 2 years, because I said 1 episode a week originally. I was like, this could go on for 4 years. I just was like, no, it'll go past the 25th anniversary of the movie, and it's like, no, we don't want that to happen. So we're just getting this. We're getting this happening now. But guys, it's the 78th minute. As usual on the show, we do a little bit of business at the beginning just to say it is the theatrical release Blu-ray, which is not the glorious 4K definitive edition with all the colors regraded and the sound pretty damn amazing. And the 4K Blu-ray is just slightly off. For whatever reason, the time codes on about three of the different releases, whether it's the DVD and the Blu-ray or the more definitive edition, the 4K, or if you got it on VOD, because I know, you know, many people on this on this podcast who are subscribers might have it on multiple devices, like if you just want it on your iPhone like me, so you can occasionally watch the Christopher Nolan Q&A with Michael Mann and Al Pacino and Robert De Niro just for fun while you're at work, listening to them talk and listening to Chris Nolan ask really highfalutin questions to Robert De Niro, and Robert De Niro like look at Pacino and Michael Mann and go, how the hell do I answer this thing? It's if you're that kind of person, you might have it on multiple devices. But as always, we will watch the minute. I'll do my best to explain the minute, where it's at exactly and precisely, so you can cue it up, and then we'll go from there. But the minute we're up to is we've had an amazing minute. Just it's an amazing sequence. It's finally Vincent Hanna, Pacino's crew, is on Neil's crew, and they've just discovered it. And it really an incredibly dynamic scene between, I guess, Chris Chehalis, who's Neil, Robert De Niro's main confidant, and sort of he gets posed the question, what the hell should we do? We've got the heat. The heat is around the corner. And what are we going to do with this? Chris is definitive. He's like, we need to do this. We've got to go for it. I know it might be a bad idea, but this is where I jump out. And Tom Sizemore pretty much has his most emotional and sort of most sophisticated, I guess, would you say, Mark? Most sophisticated performative moment of the film, because he's like having to he's having to wrestle over what the hell to actually do, he's not being ordered. He's a great soldier. He's not being ordered by Neil to do something. He's saying, no, you make your decision, because if you say where go, and more people want to do this, we'll do it. So we're just on the cusp of that, and we get some great Danny Trejo. We get some great Pacino stalking. We lead right up to the beginning of the infamous great ass scene. And I'm sorry that Mark's not here, but I thought I would bring him in nice and close to that scene, because he's obviously, as a Pacino aficionado, that is a great and important scene in the canon. So we'll watch this minute together now. You guys can listen along, and then we'll come back and talk many things about it. Here we go.
Yeah, sure. Let's go.
Fuck them. Let's do it.
All right, let's go. We got a lot of work.
Well,
you can't go in there.
Watch this.
Excuse me, that...
Tim, I gotta call you back.
Wait, you have to have an appointment.
Can I help you?
Are you Alan Marciano?
Yeah, and who the fuck are you?
How am I?
Hey!
Lieutenant Vincent Hanna, LAPD.
LA, this is Las Vegas. You don't even have jurisdiction here.
Hey!
I don't know who the fuck you guys think you're pushing around, but I know people here, okay?
Las Vegas PD takes you into custody. You are extradited to Newark on a New Jersey warrant for smuggling cigarettes up from North Carolina 3 years ago.
Or you go to work for us. What a great scene, Mark.
It's a really interesting minute, because you've got the first, you know, 10 or 15 seconds, you've got Pacino, you've got De Niro and the crew, and then all of a sudden it flips to, you know, Pacino and the crew, basically. So it's a minute where you're getting both sides. And I imagine that probably doesn't happen that much, certainly in the individual minutes, because, you know, Mann's obviously idea is to spread the scenes out, to make it long, to go long on these things. So for you to pick this minute and actually to get both sides of it, you know, the good guys and the bad guys, it's kind of an interesting idea, really, because you were like, now we're going to talk about the bad guys, then we're going to talk about the good guys. But, you know, we say good guys in the loosest possible terms, I guess.
Yeah, and you're right, because the first time we've seen Pacino, as in Hanna and the Robbery Homicide Division crew, they're above the restaurant, they're behind that neon sign, behind the cage, you know, that beautifully lit scene by Dante Spinotti, and they're looking down, you know, these guys can get the surprise of a lifetime sort of scene. But here we see them in their work clothes, they're out there, they're in the middle of work, and it's like, I love the echoes between scenes, and so I love that this minute straddles two very different scenes, but in the same theme as you're talking about, which is one where he's like,
where he asked Trejo, he's like, yeah, and you? And he's like, yeah, you know, whatever. You know, it's good. Like, after all the drama of Chris and then Michael, he asked Trejo, he's like, yeah, whatever.
That's my favorite thing about it. I love that at the beginning where, you know, as you said, there's this emotional thing where they're like, listen, guys, if you want to do it, you've got to come in, you've got to, and whatever else. And there's the anger, and they go, and you? And he goes, yeah, fuck it, man, whatever. I don't give a shit. You know, and you're like, you know, I don't think he's in the film enough, to be honest with you. I know that obviously, you know, he's kind of a secondary character, and obviously later on that there's a big issue with him. But early on, we don't get enough of him, especially with attitude like that. Yeah, fuck it, man, just do it. I don't give a shit.
I think there's, and I'll probably reference it again, but I think Trejo, you know, as a new actor, like, this is a guy who's been in prison. And he comes out into the scene and he starts getting into acting. He does this and Robert Rodriguez's Desperado almost around the same time. But it's like a guy learning how to act. And like, as much as people like might tease Danny Trejo or Danny Trejo movies or whatever, or have a laugh at it, he's really like quite an accomplished actor. Like, he can pull off things. And this time he's so green. So Michael Mann, I think, uses him to perfect effect. Like, let the two guys who are, you know, these powerhouse actors have these emotional moments, and then just ease the, I guess, the tension or the, you know, the heightened state that we're in by just like a guy who goes, yeah, fuck it, who gives a shit?
It's kind of sucking the tension out of the scene within a brief moment.
1 second.
You know, you, as you said, you kind of go, wow, okay, yeah, all of this, and then all of a sudden it just sucks it out.
Yeah, and he's like, we got work to do. So you just bang straight into the next scene. But you're right. Work clothes here, where I'm just sort of playing the minute as Mark and I are talking on mute. And then bang, it's literally, I think it's 13 seconds into the minute and 17 seconds into the minute. We're already seeing the guys. And then we see Drucker and we see Casals and Wes Studi and obviously Pacino and the Nevada policeman and just like a uniform cop with them as they're walking through. But I love that... I love how quickly here in this moment, it's so funny. This is one of my favorite parts of this entire minute, Mark. I think it might be even one of my favorite parts of the entire movie. Just a little subtle thing. It was where the woman goes, you can't go in there. And he just goes, watch this. He just walks in.
But he doesn't even look at her. That's the thing. If you watch him, he's looking into the office and the woman is on the other side, basically. And as you said, she goes, oh, you can't go in there. And he goes, watch this. As you know, it's so funny. But I just want to go back to the just before that, where you first see Hannah and the rest of his team walking. There's this music to it, this beat of music that it's kind of... It's like a pounding guitar. It's almost like the guitar from the Beastie Boys' Sabotage to a certain degree.
Yes.
And it feels like it's an entrance music. You know, if you were like a WWE wrestler or something, you have your own entrance music. That's what it feels like in this moment. Like, you've got, here's the Hannah entrance music. No, 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 no. And it matches up with them walking as well. This is the beauty of it. It's kind of like the, as I said, entrance music. Here they are. Get ready. Because something's going to go down.
And what's even funnier is we're just watching this minute on a loop right now as we're talking, but it's like, she goes to talk to him and he goes, watch this. He just doesn't even acknowledge.
Nope.
And you get Marciano and this is the balls of Marciano and like the fake braggadocio bravado that he has. I love, which is there's a cop in uniform. There's a massive bald Nevada police officer who he has no idea who he is. You have the incredibly like hulking man that Michael T. Williamson is. He's huge. Like, he's a huge guy. Wes Studi, like, extremely intimidating looking man. And Pacino, the most diminutive of all those guys, but has that intensity. So he comes in with like, are you Alan Marciano? And he's confident, but he's not hostile. And then this idiot, like, he puts his finger in his face 35 seconds and you can see the great Wes Studi just frozen. I'm just like, you can see, and it's the change in Pacino's behavior almost instantaneously that is perfect, because as soon as that finger goes in his nose, like, who the hell do you think you are, he just bang grabs his hand, flips him over the table, doesn't give a crap, throws him down into his table. And then starts the spiel. But it's like, I almost think Exactly like you were talking about before, he's got this show entrance, and if he was being respected in that scene, you would imagine that Vincent plays it in an almost completely different manner.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
the fact that that index finger nearly touches the tip of his nose, I think that it just completely, it completely changes everything.
It does, absolutely. Well, it's, you know, the way that the camera is shot is behind Marciano. So we don't really get to see him until he is flipped around. So you're seeing it behind, you're seeing Hannah and everybody walk in. And then as Marciano stands up, the camera follows him, moves behind him. And then when we get the finger in the face, that's when we see who this guy is, really. But at the same time, it's kind of interesting to watch because the camera goes right into his face. Look how close it gets into Marciano's face. It's really tight. It's almost like, and also if you notice, there's a little desk lamp there, which is an underlight. And when Marciano gets pushed onto the desk by Hannah, he's kind of under the light a little bit, almost like, you know, those classic police procedural moments where put him under the lights, make him sweat. It's almost like that. I mean, you know, you're watching it here. Look, he goes right under that light. Look, and then the light is on him. You know, it's kind of an interesting way to show it. Do you know what my favorite bit about this whole thing is? Where Hannah shows him the badge, but realistically, he doesn't. He just goes, yeah, it's here, bye. You know, he showed, and goes,
it's just the cursory glance. It's the cursory glance.
It is.
I'm just struck by it and watching it in a loop over and over again. Like, what is that particular image? It's like, it's 25 seconds into the minute. And it's that, like, that's like the James Bond villain boss.
Yeah.
Like, even Dr. Claw from, like, Inspector Gadget moment for Hank Azaria's Alan Marciano. Because it's like, he's being shot from the back. It exudes power because it's sort of all blurred. He's in the foreground. It's the back of his head. His foot's up on his desk. And there's other stuff happening in front of him. And then it's like when the focus shifts, it's like the power shifts. Like, that's literally, he's in there on the phone acting like he's all powerful. And then when Vincent walks in, it's a complete shift. And I love that it's not a cut. It's a camera being moved and stood up. And then back down, it does a great pivot back down to his face, exactly like you said. Here's my badge, just as a cursory glance, the light, and then bang. It's this beautiful dance with the camera. It's not cuts, it's movements. And then you get the two shot that's set up. Perfect for the next explanation. And I just love, and I'm just sort of pointing out to Mark, I love the staging of these three guys because they are all in pristine focus. You know, even though the lighting is softened back on Wes Studios Casals in the background, he's got such a miraculously, I would say, expressive face without doing too much. He just can do the most passive of, like, tiny gestural changes on his face, and like you can read so much into it, but it's just that great thing, great lines. Here we are. Just so good.
It's they are stood in the background. You can see them because they're letting Hannah take the lead, as they always do, because, you know, this is the guy with the ball size of dumper trucks. Why wouldn't you let this guy lead? I'm just going to stand in the back. And then obviously what happens is in this moment is that actually Hannah stops talking, and obviously Mikati Williamson starts talking, and it's a lot calmer. There's a little, you know, it's almost like there's a serene moment from a policeman.
How good is that? It's the beginning of Drucker, they're talking, but you got to love, I haven't really noticed it before. Look at the wave. Look at the wave that this cop gives him. He's like, he's from Nevada. The wave is just peeks into the bottom of frame. How freaking cool is that? Hold on, I'm going to press play. Bang. There it is. See the little wave that pops up? Oh, sorry, you couldn't see it. I didn't have it framed up for you. But
no, it's fine because you can kind of understand it because, I mean, he is Las Vegas police. So really, as they said, he's got the jurisdiction there. So he should be the one who's doing the talking.
Yes.
Because he's going to tell them. No, the guy, he just waits. He just stands there because clearly he stood at the back. He's like, I'm not going, you know, toe-to-toe with Hannah. I'm just going to let this guy just go completely bonkers about it. Yeah, I mean, there he is just waving away at him. Yeah, I'm here, but I'm just going to let this guy, this crazy guy, do all of the talking, even though realistically he's got nothing at all. He can't do anything, but I'm just here to sort of prop him back up. But he's the fourth in command, really. When you look at who's in that room, Absolutely. He's fourth command, even though he's not. You know, he's the guy who's got everything. That's what makes me laugh about it. It really does. You know, I mean, it's and that guy's a mountain of a man. He's a big guy. And you think even he's not going to take on Hannah, who is, you know, the diminutive Pacino, very small. Everybody takes the piss out of his height and whatever else. But
I think this movie, leave it. But Michael Mann, I think one thing Michael Mann does well is he uses physicality appropriately. Like, Vincent is physical, and so is De Niro. De Niro's always been the more physical of the two actors, you know, obsessively with Raging Bull, etc. Like, he's the guy who's been cut and had his shirt off for a whole movie, etc. Cape Fear, Max Cady, you know, crazy. But there's no moment where, you know, where he doesn't feel like he's going to get into a scrap. Like, Vincent will get into a scrap with you. Like, you're in trouble if you're Marciano. Like, Marciano doesn't look happy. And Pacino looks totally comfortable throwing him down into a chair. And he's got his big guys standing there. He's not getting the goons to do the dirty work. Like, hey, Drucker, grab this guy because he's pointing his finger in my face. He's like grabbing his hand and going, bang, get in that freaking chair. Get on the table first. It's just a nice dance. It's just such a great little bit of choreography with shifting focuses all around. It's clearly had to be steady-cammed. To do those movements, unless they designed it on a, would they have done it on a dolly to do those angles? Do you think?
I mean, part of me thinks it is because it's a very static. You know, the camera is not moving all over the place if you were holding it. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, if it is, if somebody is just holding that camera, then wow, they've got the steadiest hand ever.
Yeah,
they really have.
Because it might be on a dolly because it does come up in a really lovely steady arc. But then it swings back down nicely into that point, and then pans up again, down, and then into the chair and around before it does the next setup. But it's a really, you know, the blocking of that particular sequence has to be perfect because the camera's got to hit focuses on shift and hit focuses and maintain the room focus as it goes down, because it doesn't lose focus when it's on Azaria's face under the lamp, as you pointed out in that great sort of old school interrogation look. I've been, you know, as part of this project, I continually dive into people writing about Michael Mann and the preparation and things like that these actors went through. And one of the more recent things, which is sort of, I'm trying to find more that's written about it, but they talked a lot about the crooks in this film in disguise casing a bank to rob. But they also had all of the cops in the film. And so perfectly, as Mark will see behind my right shoulder as we're talking, is this interrogation like? Because they had all the cops interrogate real crooks, like real former crooks, like get them into interrogation rooms just for the exercise of what it would be like to try and get information.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so funny because, like, it doesn't really have anything significant in a completely, like, direct sense where they're interrogating someone. But Hannah does it all the time. You know, Tarina... now with Hank Azaria's character, Hugh Benny later, they're like full on interrogations later, you know, all sprinkled throughout this movie.
And the thing is, as well, is these interrogation moments are not your standard police procedural interrogation things that most of us are used to, that we see in the standard films, standard TV shows. You know, the aggression here is way over the top. Yeah. Way over the top. Yeah. I mean, the machismo that's oozing from Hannah is ridiculous. You know, you couldn't put this scene in, you know, NCIS or anything else like that, because it would look out of place. It would look out of place in most. But because of the energy that is happening throughout this entire film, not just this sequence, but the entire film, especially with Hannah, it feels like it is a standard moment in Hannah's life. It feels like it's a standard moment in Cassell's life as well. You know, like he's like, yeah, this is how we are. This is how we are. You know, he's the big guy. I'm just going to stand at the back. And here's the funny thing as well, is you'll see this as well. Actually, the it's brilliant that you've got the scene paused just there. So this is 49 seconds into this minute. If you look at Cassell's in the background, he's stroking the gun. He's stroking the gun. He's the only person who's got a gun out in this entire sequence. But he stood there and he's like, yeah, I've got a silver gun out. That's right. What of it? I'm happy to use it. Get rid. And the thing is, as well, is it's not like an AK-47 or anything else like that. No, it's a really small gun.
He's just he's just nursing his revolver and gently patting it.
This is the thing. I don't know if this is on purpose or not, but you know, the position of where he's gently stroking it as well has not gone unnoticed either. You know, I mean, it's not as though he's got it up by his chest or anything else like that. It's around the groin area.
But it's,
you know,
it's in the eye line. It's in the eye line. Like, look at where Azaria's eye line is, and then look at that gun. It's like exactly in his eye line. As soon as Vincent stands up, he's going to catch it. But you're right. I think it's about opposing energies, though, because Hannah is like high energy and keeping him completely off guard. And what you love about the Nevada cop who's standing in the corner, and you love about Casals, and you love about Michael T. Williamson, as all their characters and performers, they are standing there like statues. Like, this is so normal to me. Like, we will let this guy go. Like, we're not like, stop, Vincent. There's no good cop, bad cop. It's just aggressive cop, and we're just here. Like, we're just the passive audience. You know how many times we've seen this happen? And imagine how much more disconcerting it would be, you know, if you've ever been unlucky enough to have someone be aggressive at you, and someone thinks that it's going to get violent, or someone's with that person, they think it's going to get violent, they will go and grab that person. And you're like, oh, okay. This is not usual. But if someone just stood there and let someone be completely hyper aggressive at you, you're like, oh, I'm in really big trouble, because this happens a lot. This, like, even unconsciously, this happens a lot. And it's exactly your point. This happens a lot in the world of Vincent Hanna. This composite of three crazy people.
Yeah. This is not Hannah going full tilt crazy either. You can, look at their faces behind him. They're like that. Yeah, this is normal. You know, I think that if Hannah had gone beyond the edge, which, you know, he does in this film anyway, but I'm talking so far beyond, they would probably pull him back. But we don't see that because, as you said, this is the standard. This is what he's like. We're used to it. It's not our fault you're not used to it. This is the game now. You know, we're the new police.
And you wonder if he's, you know, what's so cool about this scene, just from a narrative perspective, you know, is before we get into sort of really awesome power dynamics, like visually displayed, but like they've already got him by the balls, so to speak, when they walk in the room, which is, we've got you on a beef that's going to extradite you to New Jersey on a warrant for illegally exporting things, or you work for us. And so that's the whole spiel. It's like, right now, I don't like care about you. You are not like, you're so nothing to me. I've already got you pinched if I want. You're done. So just cooperate with me. Don't be a smart ass. Don't give me any lip, because it's over. Like, it doesn't matter. And it's, I feel like in that moment, it's that finger, that great shift of power, that finger that like makes Hannah go nuts here. Cause he's like, this guy is going to get, like, this guy was already gone when I walked in. Like, he just wanted to say, watch this. He was ready to just go and hand this guy, you know, hand him his shitty cards deck, shitty hand of cards that he was about to deal in anyway. But it's like the fact that he did that, but like, and you know, that's the whole beauty, just going onto the visuals. That's the whole beauty of like the power dynamic shifting here. You've got James Bond villain style, you know, Captain Claw sitting behind his desk, or Dr. Claw rather, sitting behind his desk. He's there. He's in all the power. He's in all the focus. And then literally when he's standing up, he stands up. He's still the man. He's still towering a bit over Vincent. The finger goes up, and then bang, the whole power shifts. Bang, on the table. What are you doing? And it's just that brief moment for a split second. We're like, is Vincent going to be this guy? What's Vincent going to do? Yeah. Oh, no, Vincent's going to do exactly what we know Vincent's going to do in the entire movie.
Well, that's the thing, as you said as well, is the fact that, you know, I think Hannah is pissed off because he gets up and he goes towards him with an aggressive manner. And Hannah's like, sorry, nobody does that to me. I do that to you. I come to you and smash you in the face. You don't start poking your finger in my face. And that's what changed, as you said. It wouldn't surprise if he'd have just sat there like most people in most TV shows where they go, we're behind the desk. Sorry, who are you? What do you want? It would have been fine. It would never have played out like this. No. But because he's got that aggression, and part of me, thinks that it is that American Psycho attitude as well, you know, like Patrick Bateman, where obviously he comes out, I've got the suit on, I've got the shiny shoes, you don't come, you know, listen, you don't talk to me like that, I talk to you and whatever else. And then all of a sudden he realizes, actually, I'm up against the wrong person here. And within that, as you said, within that split second, the power shifts so quickly in that room. It doesn't move around. It just goes from one man into a suit to another man in a suit, but it is completely different. It really is.
And it's, I think, you know, you're an English guy, I'm an Aussie guy. It would be unconscionable. So this is one just for American listeners of One Heat Minute. It would be unconscionable for most Aussie folk or British folk that if a cop comes up to talk to you, to ever act flippantly or just keep going about your business. Yeah. So one of the things of watching Law and Order for like Aussies and Brits is like one huge cultural divide is that you often see the cops in Law and Order, they're like, they'll go to a mechanic. You know, it might just be a character who like saw a person who worked on a person's car as a suspect for a murder. And so when they go talk to that mechanic, he's still working. Like he's got his hands dirty, his hands in an engine, he's changing a battery, whatever. And I just go, that would never be an Aussie person or a Brit. Like it would just never. We would stop, panic, wonder if we'd done any crimes, where was I speeding, all those things. And then go, oh crap. And then sit down at the office, wash your hands, you know, sit down with the police, let them ask you questions, and then you get back to your job. But it's just so funny. It just doesn't happen. Like, so what I love about this is that it's that sense of entitlement. It's very, you know, he's a New Jersey guy as well. You get that little bit of detail. So like this guy's probably had some dodgy connections, you know, all of that, you know, it's as rich as The Godfather to go back to like, you know, New Jersey imports, exports, you know, Sopranos comes on not too many years later than this. It's you're not surprised that there's a guy like that, that acts like Hank Azaria that would get in the face of a cop. Like, you don't have anything on me. Bugger off. It's so funny. But like, that's one of the things I'm like, that would never, if that was an Australian, it would just never happen. It would just never happen. Go, I'm sorry, what?
It wouldn't. Yeah. It wouldn't happen here either. You know, as you said, we would sweat profusely and think, my goodness, what? Oh my God, he's coming over to talk. And then they'll go, do you know where you can get a good sandwich around here? And you go, Yeah. And then you talk really quickly to get it out and get rid of them as well. You know, even something like that. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, it is this moment is so alien to some of us.
Yes.
And yet so normal to a lot of people as well, that it's kind of funny how different it is and how different it plays out to everybody.
And we've, you know, later on in Michael Mann's work, and particularly – I like this bit of business as well around the explanation of the jurisdictions, because it could be a plot hole that not many people even care about also, just from like a pure plotting. I'm saying some exposition so people understand what's happening. Is he doesn't really need to do this. Like this big bald guy who's currently on the minute at 51 seconds that I've just paused on from the Nevada police, he doesn't need to really be even in this scene, but it's just important to go, if you've got a guy who's seeing a girl, he's from Nevada, there's no reason why an LA robbery homicide division cop is talking to this guy ever. And I think that gives him a little bit of like a modicum of bravery again to go like, oh, you're from LAPD. What the hell are you doing here? You know, like gives him that last little bit of, you know, thinking that he can wriggle out of the situation. It's great. You know, just really punchy structure. Take a look. There's your mate. He waves to you. He's going to take you in on a beef that goes you to New Jersey and gets you extradited and gets you there unless you get to work for us. So it's just that good little turn of phrase, and it's a great way to sort of clear up a potential plot hole or something that was like inauthentic in that scene. It just goes bang, bang, bang. He knows what he's talking about, and then it gets into the fun bits. But
the great bit just after this is where Hannah leans back and he's still pulling on his tie, still pulling on Marciano's tie. He just keeps pulling on it, just keeps pulling him in, It's brilliant. I mean, it's so much fun. It really is. It's just pulling him in as well, you know. And I just think, well, here's the thing about, I can tell you this story, actually. This whole sequence was shot on April 25th, 1996. How do I know that? That's because that was Hank Azaria's birthday. And this was his first day of filming, basically. So what happened was they'd had the table reads and whatever else. And, you know, there was no great ass. Well, it was there in the script, obviously, but I can't imagine that they played it out. So first day on set, he knows what's coming. And yet at the same time, he doesn't know what's coming because, you know, Pacino just goes.
And at the 57th second, just sorry to interrupt your story. We're just watching the freeze frame. If you want to listen to Mark, the rest of Mark's story, you need to look at this freeze frame of Hank Azaria's just face. Agog. He just does not know what is going on. It's great.
Well, this is the thing, is that all of a sudden he's like, I'm out of the realms of standard acting. And you know, that's what happens actually in the next minute where he goes, Jesus. You know, it's almost like he can't compute that actually we're still acting. Or is Pacino actually going to, you know, knock seven bells of shit out of me? I don't know. But that's the beauty about this, is the fact that he turns up for work. He's thinking, yeah, great. It'll all go perfectly fine, whatever else. And then all of a sudden Pacino turns up and goes, right, I'm going to throw you on the desk. I'm going to pull your tie. I'm going to keep nodding into you and whatever else. And the funny thing about it is everything that you see in this moment is the first take. Because that's what Mann liked about it. Mann liked the fact that Azaria didn't know what was happening. And he was reacting to it, great. But at the same time, he was half reacting as Marciano and half reacting as himself.
All of this cut up into this moment, until there's like a turn of phrase here where there's a couple of cuts. Everything we've seen so far is one cut, which is Mark's exactly right on. It's perfect. It goes ahead. The shock is there. But it was a few cuts later because, like, the scene wasn't working when Pacino eventually did the great ass thing and, like, got in his face about it. But the reaction, like, because it wasn't working, so he just was doing things. He was like, ah, like, you're a great ass. But, like, this whole scene, the pulling on the tie, the face agog, like, how attuned was Al Pacino to Vincent Hanna to just live that, to, like, make someone look like that, to make someone look like that in a scene with
him? This is the thing, but this is what goes back to the method acting. You know, we don't talk about method acting enough at all because there's very few practice in method acting now. You know, very few of the newcomers, to be honest.
Yes.
So this is method acting. This is Pacino going into the role. And I'm not just talking about spending, you know, half an hour or an hour finding the character or, you know, like, what's his name who played the Joker sending dildos to his cast member. No, that's not method acting. That's not method. You know, you spend months. And as you were saying earlier, actually, Blake, you know, they spent time with the real police interrogation. They spent time with real police learning how to shoot as well. So, you know, this is full method acting from Pacino, even when it's full on crazy, where, as we said earlier, it wouldn't happen. It just wouldn't happen, something like this. Pacino dials that method acting up further. It goes to 11, basically. And this is what you get. You get this type of reaction, which, if you were filming the scene, you said, yeah, this is what's going to happen. We want you to respond to it. Chances are he would go, oh, wow, blimey. I said, you know, it wouldn't have that shock value to it, which is what you've got on the screen at the moment, which is brilliant, where he's just kind of agog. He's like, his mouth is open. Like, I have no idea what to say to this guy at all. And it kind of feels like in that moment, he's probably going to just tilt his head to the side, look at Michael Mann and go, are we still going? Happening now.
And one thing that I've watched again, and this is like really recurred to me in some stuff that I've been doing for some additional research of Heat, like just trying to get make sure there's no stone unturned in any of my Heat research. One thing that Mann has said in like maybe four or five consecutive different documentaries and interviews I've heard about Heat is he does not, and in all of his films, he likes to rehearse to know enough to know the pacing, to know the blocking. To know those things, but he never wants to be, you know, and there's the most famous and a Pacino alumni and fellow director, Sidney Lumet, as well. Sidney Lumet would rehearse the living daylights out of his actors and then get them on to set and then do the movie. Whereas Mann is a little bit, for all of the preparedness, he's a guy who doesn't like to rehearse too much, just enough, because he feels that there's like one perfect, he goes, people will do a scene once or twice perfectly and then it's gone. Like it's completely gone. Mm. And so it's even to the point in this where you're, like you said, they come in, there's the energy, there's the ferocity, And then you can't sustain that forever, right? Like you can't, it's not possible to sustain it. And so I think that's what's really, really cool is that it is sustained here. They do what they've got to do. And then, you know, in the next minute, we're going to talk about it. You guys are going to listen to it. You know, that infamous scene is like, it's the purity of, he's embodying the character. What would the character do to completely take this guy even further off base? I'm just going to shock him. And then the perfection of the shock is also like, you know, he's already agog, but the perfection of the shock in the next scene is even better for that reason. Because it's just like bang once or twice. And it happens.
I want to say something else as well. You've got it at 57 seconds. If you can scoot it to 59 seconds, there's a shot of Pacino, basically. As it comes back from Marciano with his mouth agog and whatever else, it goes back to Pacino. And you can see, just as he finishes talking, basically, he rolls his tongue. He rolls it in that cocksure manner. You know how you have people who just sort of chew their tongue when they've done something right? They go, I'm so good here. I'm so good. It's that type of cocksure that it's just there. It's just a little turn of the tongue. And it's brilliant because it is, yep, I've got it. You know, here we are. Fantastic. But also, and this is something that me and you touched upon when I was on last time, Blake, was when we were talking about when we first discovered that actually Hannah was on drugs and they never put it into the film, but actually, obviously, you know, subsequently they have told everybody. Part of me wonders if this roll of the tongue is also to try and clean his teeth to get, you know, the last little dregs of what's going on there to keep him pumped. Because obviously in the next minute you have that great ass sequence. Is that coming from him rolling the tongue, getting a bit off his teeth, and all of a sudden his intensity going right back up again, you know, because the drugs are hitting his system so quickly. But the tongue roll is brilliant. I think
you could be spot on with saying that's you could read that. It's the most insulting sort of like I own you. Regardless of whether it was that or not, and I think, you know, depending on how deep Pacino went with that, I think it's a good read. I think it's definitely a valid read in like the revisionist view of this entire movie of, you know, Vincent Hanna as a dude who chips cocaine to hunt down crooks or to stay sharp. But like, I just think right now he's in his element. He's like, he's set his spiel. He's got this guy by the balls. His face is agog. He's like, oh, I own you. Like, I'm just going to toy with you now because you're an idiot. Like, you weren't going to get any of this from me. But that one finger in my nose is such a profound insult for someone like him that it's just like, no. And what I love is I like Vincent so much in the big moments because I think it all suits exactly what the character is to the ground. When he's playing with someone who he doesn't respect, he treats them like this. He yells at them. He gets in their face because he shows them that he doesn't care. Like, you can't do anything to me. And then you get someone like Neil, who he deeply respects, and he's not going to act like this with Neil. There's no tongue hanging out. There's no there's no unnecessary swagger. It's stoicism. It's strength. It's reaction and, you know, equal reactions. Like, I think, man, a couple of times it's like two great boxers, you know, when someone faints one way, they parry the next way, you know, they do their thing. And so here he's just like, it's like he's the heavyweight champion of the world and he's just sparring a guy who's had one fight. It's like, this is nothing.
You're exactly right with that, actually, Blake. And you know what it reminds me of? Because you just said boxers there. If anybody ever remembers the boxer Prince Nassim Hamid from about, 20 years ago, British boxer, he had that same swagger. You know, he was a guy who went undefeated for years and years, and he would turn up at the ring and, you know, he just had this entire swagger about him. So you saying it's a boxer, I'm now looking and I'm thinking, if that was going to be a boxer, that would be Prince Nassim Hamid in his heyday because, you know, he had that type of cocky swagger where he just, you know, he hadn't even started boxing yet and he would look at the opposition in the opposite side of the ring and just go, I already own you. It does not matter. And that's what Hannah is doing in that right at the end of this moment with the tongue roll. He's going, yep, you're mine. It does not matter
that you're
sat down. It does not matter that we are from LA and you're in Las Vegas. It doesn't matter. You're still mine.
Well, on that note, this has been another exceptional episode of 1 Heat Minute with a true Pacino aficionado, Mr. Mark Cervi. The tongue roll, it's got everything. We started this minute, we started this minute with Danny Trejo just not giving a flying fuck about what he was doing. We're ending it with Pacino equally giving no fucks about the plight of Alan Marciano. Another great minute coming for you guys. Another previous minute you guys will catch us on. There's just having a great time on the show. We'd love to hear from you. Subscribe, rate, review, and you know, lots of great minutes, lots of great guests. Mark is definitely coming back. There's more Pacino for us to have in another circa 80s. Where are we at? We're at 73. So there's like, damn, 97 episodes to go. Wowza. So there are 97 episodes to go. So we'll find time to get Mark back. Mark, thank you so much again for being a part of 1 Heat Minute and joining us on the show.
A pleasure as always, Blake. You know, I mean, anytime I get to talk about Heat, which now, having released the book, I may have said this before, I think this is Pacino's most expansive film. I think it's the film where you get the most different types of Al Pacino. You know, I know the Godfather is obviously the greatest film ever made, but at the same time, from here, as I said earlier, you get the method, you get the comedy, you get the seriousness, you get the romance as well. Let's not forget that, you know, he's still very good looking in this film as well. So for me, I always kind of say that if you want the full spectrum of Pacino, you've got to watch Heat.
And I would equally say that for De Niro. The more that I watch it, particularly that scene, the scene in the coffee shop for everyone, you know, that perfection, Michael Mann talks about it, take 11. And I actually found, Mark, just so you know, this is a nice little bit of trivia, in that in one of the early trailers, they used an alternate cut of De Niro's dialogue. Like,
really?
So in one of the so in the actual scene, De Niro says, "And I will not hesitate, not for a second." And then in the trailer, it actually says, "I will not hesitate for a second." And I'm like, that's got to be an alternate take. It's not the actual take that we saw, which is take 11. But I agree. When I look at De Niro in this, they're both peak handsome for their careers. They both look, you know, as adult men, they're like handsome. They're not the young man, you know, brash handsome that they were when they were younger. They're the most handsome they are as adults, which I think is a very valid point. And the next thing is they both do hugely different things. I think this movie leans into both guys' strengths. You know, there is not another scene where either of those actors act against someone as good as them, except for the Godfather movies.
Which they're both in. We know which they're both in as well.
They're both in as well.
We're going round and round in circles.
They're both
here,
in as
really.
Well, but here we are. Mark, thank you so much again. Guys, markcerby.com. @Mark_Serby if you want to check him out there. His book, Al Pacino, The Movies Behind the Man, is excellent. A stack of interviews in his book about Heat is where Studi Casals, great. You know, so for all psychopaths like me, this is one of the essential pieces of research that needs to happen for this project. Always a pleasure to have Mark on. Mark, thank you so much again. Garth Franklin, thank you for our web design. Mr. Paul Davies, thank you for our awesome theme. And guys, as always, thank you for listening. We'll catch you on another Minute of Heat. Around the corner.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.